A pitch-dark house, maybe full of lethal surprises, was a different ballgame altogether. He looked into the ensuite bathroom. Blue and white tiles, blue tub, and towels monogrammed with an L were neatly arranged on a built-in shelf. No dead bodies were behind the shower curtain or stuffed in the linen closet. He grabbed a washcloth and used it to open the medicine cabinet, where he found the typical items like face powders, a box of Tampax, creamy moisturizers, tonics, and other patent medicines. He also found a bottle of black hair dye and a hair straightener. So the lady was not a natural brunette with straight locks. Why had she lied about that? He next searched the other rooms up here. One was no doubt a guest bedroom, outfitted in Spartan fashion, with a bathroom that was half the size of hers. But maybe Lam didn't want to encourage guests, so she made the accommodations uninviting on purpose. He could easily see her being that sort of introvert. Another room was obviously Lam's office or writer's den, or literary sweatshop, whatever one wanted to deem it. There was a portable Smith Corona typewriter in its open carrying case on a desk with a chair in the knee hole. Next to it were stacks of yellow legal pads and loose white pages with notes and doodles littered over them. They all seemed to pertain to various scripts she was working on. On the other side of the typewriter was a script marked Betty Davis Film. He didn't bother to open it. If he ended up seeing the movie, he wanted to be surprised. There were other scripts marked Draft, stacked next to it from a number of other projects with several other studios. Lam was one busy scribe. Next to the telephone was a Wheeldex. He fingered through the cards there and saw some famous names and others that were obscure. His first inclination was to take the whole thing. His second inclination won out, and the Wheeldex stayed where it was. He looked through the drawers and found a check register. There was no bank balance listed, but her checks seemed to be made out to the sort of folks he made checks out to. He made a note that she banked with the Second National Bank of Malibu. He wondered if the First National Bank of Malibu was still in business, and if so, why a town this small needed a spare. Against one wall was a small leather couch with fluffy pillows embroidered with cats and puppies, and a coffee table with stacks of books. There were bookshelves filled with more books and scripts. The sole window held a view of the canyon. Archer noted that Lamb's back would be to it. Focus, focus, apparently. A large world globe sat next to the couch. When he hinged it open, revealed was a bar with bottles and glasses arrayed in round cut holes. He glided down the stairs, reached the ground level, and turned to his right. He stumbled hard and hit the floor with a grunt. His light fell from his left hand, and his gun was knocked out of his right with a sudden impact. The next moment, he was smacked on the back of the head with something hard enough to qualify as a blunt instrument. He briefly saw fireworks, and then the flames went out, and the coal black around him became complete. When he slowly came to, he rubbed his neck and stretched out his jaw, which had seized up with the blow to his skull. Vague stars knitted against a black background floated through his mind. He slowly checked his watch. It was now after 4 in the morning. He reached up and massaged the back of his head where a lump had risen like a volcano from the ocean of his scalp. His fingers came away sticky with his blood. He groped around for his light and his gun. He found both and turned the light on to see what he had stumbled over. The person was dead. That was certain. The pupils were fixed, and neither one bit even a little on Archer's light. Only it wasn't Eleanor Lamb. It was a man. Someone had ushered him into 1953 with one right between the eyes. Chapter 10. The first thing Archer did was find a bathroom on the main floor off the foyer, where he threw up everything he'd eaten and drunk on New Year's Eve. The White Russian felt particularly egregious coming back up his throat, like his own painfully private Cold War. After that, he snagged a washcloth, filled it with some cubes from the refrigerator, and laid it over the bloody bump on his head. He'd had concussions before, and he knew he was suffering from one now. He sat on the bottom step and stared dully at the dead man. The guy was in his 50s, with thinning gray hair and a florid face that was turning paler by the minute. He was around 5'10 and about 200 pounds. The bullet wound on his face was blackened, with the skin crusted up like furrows of dirt in a tilled field. That told Archer that whoever had shot him had been close to the guy. He was dressed in a gray two-piece that looked off the rack, and was baggy and off-kilter in all the places a cheap suit always was. His tie was red and too short. It barely reached the top of his now slack belly. Archer looked at his face more closely. There were bruises on his cheeks and jaw, and one on his neck. His nose looked puffy and swollen. He checked the dead man's pockets. The suit was courtesy of Sears, Roebuck & Company, the label said. If this was the Ford man, Archer could match the name from the car. Only the fellow had no ID and no wallet, and no car keys. And there was no business card or other clue that would solve the whole thing in short order. So someone had rolled him and taken everything that could tell who he was. Except the damn car. So is this Cedric Bender? That would make sense. The car was outside and the dead guy was inside. But Archer needed to be sure. He glanced down at the corpse again. Archer had no idea how the man had lived his life. But that life was now over. It was a callous and sad send-off, however he looked at it. Archer put the ice back on his head and took another minute to think what to do. He decided to search the rest of the house to make sure that Lamb wasn't lying somewhere with a hole added to her head as well. He didn't find Lamb's or any other body. He saw walls and beamed ceilings that were all painted white. The fireplace surround in the front room was etched with musical notes, and film awards were aligned on the mantel. Hanging on one wall was a cuckoo clock. There was a white china cabinet and a built-in buffet. The kitchen had all the latest appliances and gadgets, marble countertops, an island with bar stools around it, a large refrigerator with practically nothing in it, and an electric stovetop. There was a library filled with books that actually looked red, and a door that led to an outdoor shower enclosed by a wooden wall. A small dining room had a rectangular craftsman-style table with six chairs. This was no doubt where the Marses and Greens had eaten during their visit. Aside from that, there were comfortable couches, chairs, rugs, a portable bar outfitted in chrome, some paintings, interesting light fixtures, and lots of windows, both large and small. Other than that, the only things in the house were a dead body and a very much alive PI, nursing a cracked head and a bruised ego for letting someone so easily sandbag him. He went back up to Lamb's office and looked through the Wheeldex again. His fingers plucked out two cards that seemed promising, because unlike all the others, they each had a large X written in under the name. When in doubt, X marks the spot. That must be in some PI mail order course somewhere. He wrote the information down and put the cards back. He liked to play fair with the cops, even if they didn't always play fair with him. He went out the way he had come, wiping his prints off along the way. His sense of fair play had its limits. Thus, Archer wasn't about to leave behind any evidence that might earn him a trip to San Quentin to sniff a bunch of cyanide gas as the concluding frame of his personal horror flick. He got back to his car and drove off, winding his way down after winding his way up. He stopped at a call box on the highway and reported a dead body at Eleanor Lamb's house, giving the address. He didn't provide his name, rank, or PI license number despite the dispatchers demanding all personal info from him except his ring size. It might come back to bite him, but so would willingly sticking his neck out. He didn't want to meet the deputy sheriffs on the drive east. At this hour of the morning, in a car that stood out, that would only get him pulled over with difficult questions to follow. So he drove past the Sea Lion and the Albatross and headed west. When he was far enough away from Las Flores and reached a part of Malibu that was far less developed, he pulled over to the beach side and parked behind some scrub brushes, just in case the cops decided to look for whoever had called them, or killed the guy in the house. He got out, took off his shoes and socks, and put them on the car seat, then rolled up his pants and walked along the beach. It was low tide, and the coolness of the sand worked its way up to his injured head. He found a dry place to sit down and watch the ocean recede south toward San Diego and Tijuana. During the summers, a surfing crowd had started invading the beaches here. He'd watched the surfers serenade the bathing suit ladies with their tales of derring do, often strumming a ukulele while doing so. He'd seen more than one fresh-faced, wide-eyed young woman taken in by this glib crap, which usually ended with a face slap and/or a paternity suit. He looked out to the water and saw a white light. It might be from the cargo ship he had seen earlier, but then again, probably not. Enough time had passed for it to be well out of sight by now, and this light was far closer. The ship was probably making for port along the coast. Malibu was a slender appendage sticking out from the torso of California. He was on a part of Malibu Sand that also had sharp, vertical bluffs as a backstop. At high tide, some of the old caves would fill up with water. People would occasionally find gold doubloons from Spanish vessels that had gone down in the notorious storms that made this section of the coast a mariner's nightmare back in the day. In the distance a few minutes later, he heard the L.A. County Sheriff's radio patrol cars come flying along the coast road. The pitch of their sirens wound so high they could probably be heard high up in the canyons. He was too far away to see them from here, but he could imagine their flashing lights being like stark embers in the darkness. He listened to their cacophony until the canyon swallowed them all whole, just like the whale had Jonah. Only then did he rise on shaky legs and start to walk to his car. The next moment he dropped to the sand. He had happened to glance back out toward the water, and his gaze had held on that same light out there. It had changed course and was coming closer by the second. He could hear its motor revved high over the crash of the waves. He knelt there, his heart hammering, as the now revealed boat swept over the line of breakers. It quickly breached, and the men swarmed off. Archer lay flat on the sand and continued to watch as one of the men splayed a flashlight beam around the area. The light passed just over the sharp brim of Archer's hat and then swung back. Under the moonlight, he saw the other men begin to unload large crates from the boat. It had to be illegal what they were doing. Honest businesses did not do their work well before dawn on a deserted beach on the first day of the new year. He edged back on the beach as the men carrying the boxes headed to the dry sand. Some words came to him over the sounds of the breakers, Spanish, then English. Archer began to inch backward in a crab walk because the men's path was taking them dangerously close to where he was. He managed to reach a spot that seemed far enough away to commence a hasty retreat. He turned, half rose, and hoofed it, his bare feet struggling in the loose sand, and his injured head pounding beyond all reckoning. He had looked back to make sure no one had seen him, when he suddenly slammed into something hard. He and the other man went down in a tangle of arms and legs. Archer couldn't see the fellow's face because of the darkness and the extreme thrashing the two were engaged in, with their bodies rolling around violently. He had to keep shutting his eyes because their movements were causing the sand to fly all over them. Archer felt a hand reach for his throat and grip there. He pushed the palm of his hand into the man's face, levering the neck back enough to where the man gasped and let go his grip. The next instant, Archer saw the glint of a knife, and the blade came at his throat. Before it plunged into him, he grabbed the man's wrist and luckily found his strength superior to his opponent's, so he could keep the knife at bay. He smelled the garlic and tobacco breath and felt the foul spit on his face as they writhed and tussled in the sand, each trying to gain control of the weapon. Then, needing to end this before the other men on the beach saw what was happening, Archer closed his eyes, gritted his teeth, and rammed the crown of his head into the left side of the man's jaw. The man cried out, and he dropped the knife. Archer next clocked him with a stunner of a right cross, and the man fell limp to the sand, with his face turned away. Archer got to his feet, fought the blinding pain in his head, and ran for it. The sand got more densely packed the farther he went. Archer picked up speed, but his strides were still wobbly and clumsy. He heard the report of a gun and felt a round crack past him and embed itself in the wood of the fence set up to stop erosion. It couldn't have been the guy he'd fought. It had to be the men from the boat, which meant they had spotted him. He redoubled his efforts, running flat out, his breaths coming in bursts, and his heart beating so fast he wasn't sure what would give out first, his lungs or his ticker. More shots came, and with them he heard feet running hard behind him, and the cries of the men to whom those feet and gunfire belonged. As he approached the road, from the corner of his eye, he thought he saw what looked like a truck parked about 100 yards away on the edge of the sand. He reached his car, where it was hidden behind the scrub bushes, slid into the front seat, turned the key, and slammed down the starter button. The French beast roared to life. He wheeled the Delahaye around, pointed it to the coast road, and pushed his bare foot down hard on the accelerator. He hit the asphalt, and in the straightaway, he wound the car up to 100. He zipped around the first curve as the car banked around the wall of a canyon, and he was out of the sight line and range of the guns. He drove fast for another mile, and then conscious that more cops might be on the way to the murder scene, he slowed down and drove the rest of the way back to Callahan's place at a sedate pace. He reached it just about the time the milkman dropped off 3 fresh bottles on her front porch. Archer pressed his face against the steering wheel and thanked God and everyone else he could think of for sparing him tonight. Chapter 11. Callahan had given him a spare key earlier that night, just in case he needed to crash at her place in the future. He staggered inside and put the milk in the white Frigidaire refrigerator, then walked to his bathroom and cleaned up his head with a bottle of peroxide he found under the sink. It stung so badly he almost threw up again. He got some ice and put it on the growing bruise on his head, where he'd slammed it into the man's face. At least his hair hid much of the damage. He stared in the mirror and saw someone looking older now than 3 decades. 1953 was not doing wonders for him so far. In one night, he had fallen over a dead body, gotten sapped, ran into smugglers on the beach, and been nearly killed. Maybe he needed to run out and buy a box of rabbit's feet to change his fortunes. But then again, he had survived it all. So you are one lucky son of a bitch after all. And then he turned his mind to the murdered man at Lamb's place. That was his case. The smugglers were somebody else's problem. While a small gal like Lamb might not have been able to sap him that hard, she sure could employ a couple foot-pounds of force to pull a trigger. That meant the woman was not off the hook for the killing. Was the dead guy the same one who answered the phone? It wasn't like Archer could check his voice against the one he'd heard on the call. If not, who was he? The betting was pretty good that the Ford belonged to him, since the dead could not drive off into the sunset. If so, the loved ones of Cedric Bender were in for a rude shock. So who had sapped Archer? Whoever killed the guy? The shooter had cleaned out the man's pockets, presumably to prevent an ID. But he'd left the man's car across the street. How did that make sense? But if Bender was the shooter, why was his car still out there? You kill someone, you usually wanted to get away, fast. And the big question, where was Eleanor Lamb? Guilty or innocent? Dead or alive? He stripped down to his skivvies, and then flapped his clothes through an open window to get out most of the sand. He hung them up in the closet and dropped into bed, closing his eyes at 6:20. He reopened them sometime later when Callahan knocked on his door.
Archer? You in there? What's this note about? Did you go somewhere last night?
He sat up and groaned. He'd forgotten to toss the note. Don't pay any attention to it. It's a moot point.
Can I come in?
Sure.
You decent?
When the hell did that ever matter to you? She walked in wearing a white nylon chiffon robe over a pale blue nightgown, with some frill around the bodice and fluffy heelless slippers, looking as fresh and ready to go as if the late night and drinks had never happened. Sunlight was streaming in through the gaps in the Venetian blinds. That only made Archer's head throb worse. He sat up and blinked at her.
The best I can say is, you look like shit, Archer.
Well, that's exactly how I feel, so there's that. Callahan sat on the bed next to him and gaped when she saw his assortment of injuries.
What in the hell happened to your head?
She gasped. Will you make me some coffee if I tell you? He said groggily.
I'll buy you coffee and some breakfast.
He looked at his watch. It was after 12. Damn, when did that happen?
Yeah, Archer, the little hand on the clock just keeps going round and round, even when you're getting your head busted. But I know a joint around the corner. They serve breakfast until I say so, because the owner likes me. Now spill, what happened?
I went out to Lamb's place in Malibu last night.
What? Is that where you got your head bashed?
He told her about everything, including the phone call he made, and his finding the dead man, and getting sapped for his troubles, and the battle on the beach, and his nearly dying there. Callahan's expression became more and more distraught, and her hands trembled.
Oh my God, Archer! It's a miracle you're still breathing!
He sat back against the pillows and didn't reply.
You know, one day your luck is going to run out,
she warned, her expression now one of weary resignation. It wasn't all luck. She looked at his head.
You didn't do such a good job there. I can clean it up better and bandage it. I got some aspirin in my bathroom.
A half bottle should do fine.
And you don't know if anything happened to Ellie?
Does she drive a 2-door silver Chevrolet coupe?
Yes.
It was locked, and I couldn't check, so her body could be inside.
Oh, Jesus! You said the cops went there after you called them?
He nodded. I'll shower and shave, shake the rest of the sand off my clothes, and then we can get something to eat. After that, I'm going to call the LA County Sheriff's Department. I got a friend there. I'll see what I can find out.
Don't mention that you were there. They could arrest you, Archer.
Wouldn't be the first time. The cops really like busting PIs. He gave her a lopsided grin, which made his head hurt even worse. I think they're jealous we make the big bucks. She smacked him lightly on the cheek.
In that case, Rockefeller, you can buy me breakfast.
Chapter 12. After a filling meal, and with his face shaved and his clothes reasonably cleaned and his head bandaged and aspirin taken, Archer called Connie Morrison at Willie Dash's office in Baytown. He told her what had happened and asked her to find out whatever she could on Cedric Bender. He also told her about what he had seen on the beach and his struggle with the man there.
Should I tell Willie?
Morrison asked. Even if I say no, you're going to.
These last 3 years haven't been wasted on you at all, Archer.
After that, he phoned the offices of Green and Ransom. It rang and rang. Next, he called the LA County Sheriff's Department. His contact there, Barry Drews, knew all about the dead man in Los Flores Canyon. Archer said nothing about the boat and the men on the beach because he didn't want to get pulled into an unrelated case. That was, thankfully, someone else's headache.
How'd you find out so fast about the dead guy?
Drews wanted to know.
Friend of a friend.
Who's running the investigation?
Phil Oldham.
I know Phil. Would it be a problem if I went up there?
Why? What's your interest in all this?
The lady who owns that house is a client of mine. Drew said,
Any idea where she is? Because Phil and his boys can't find her.
I might be able to help. Can you call them about me coming up?
I'm not too sure about this, Archer.
Come on, Barry. We're both on the same team here.
But you keep things close to the vest.
If I didn't, I wouldn't be in the business. My clients expect confidentiality. So will you make the call? He heard the man sigh.
Just share whatever you find.
I'll do all I can on that score.
You going out soon?
Soon as I hang up with you. He put the phone down and looked at Callahan, who was sitting across from him.
Do you know what you're doing?
She asked in a worried tone. I'll find out.
But Ellie never even wrote you a check, so she's not really your client.
A guy's dead, and it looks like Lamb has vanished, and someone tried to push my brain into the rest of me. I'll figure the business end out later.
You're more of a Boy Scout than you'll admit.
He gingerly put on his hat. That's just what this town needs. More damn Boy Scouts.
Will you please be careful?
More careful than I was last night. She kissed him, not on the cheek, but on the lips. What was that for? He said, giving her a questioning look.
Luck doesn't take a genius to see that you're going to need it.
Her words were joking. The rest of the lady was not. Chapter 13. The traffic on New Year's Day was light, and Archer made good time on the drive back to Malibu. The place was named after a Chumash village, Maliwo, where the who part was silent. And Chumash had meant where the surf sounds loudly, and there was no denying that. Las Flores Canyon Road looked far different in the daylight. What was dark and foreboding then was now interesting and aesthetically pleasing. He parked in front of Lamb's house and observed right away that the dark blue Ford was no longer there. Okay, there could be two reasons for that. Either the cops impounded it, or someone else came during the night to take it. Maybe the owner, Cedric Bender. Archer chastised himself because he couldn't remember if the Ford was still there when he had left the house. His head had been hurting so badly he hadn't bothered to notice. He got out of the Delahaye after looking at the coroner's black meat wagon standing by in the driveway behind the coupe. A sedan was behind it, with the coroner plaque hung in the window. There was an old Plymouth parked at the curb, with a radio squad car nearly touching its back bumper. Archer was surprised they hadn't taken the body away by now. He gave his name to the uniform on duty and was quickly admitted into the house. Now, start to tap dance really fast, Archer. Phil Oldham was a big, blunt-faced homicide detective reluctantly housed in a Harris tweed jacket and wrinkled gray slacks that nearly matched their owner's skin. He had the reputation of being a decent cop with a sense of fair play on his good days. That made him about as rare as a politician who wasn't on the take. Oldham and two other plainclothes were standing near the body, over which someone had placed a dirty white sheet. The edge of an unlit, beaten-down stogie stuck out from the right corner of Oldham's mouth.
"Hello, Archer," he said with a nod. "I got buzzed on the two-way from Barry. Said you'd be heading over. You missed most of the show. We already took our pictures and drew our chalk line. Case is practically solved."
"Glad to hear it."
"Tell me something."
He took the stogie out and looked at it like he was wondering how it had gotten in his mouth.
"Willie Dash has a good business going up north, and I hear you're a worthy pavement pounder for him. So why play down here in the sand?"
"This one rolled right across my eyeline," said Archer.
"Understand she was a client, meaning the lady of the house?"
"That's right. She said she thought someone was trying to kill her."
"Well, unfortunately for this fellow, someone was looking to kill somebody, and he got tagged to be the corpse. But maybe the wires got crossed. Who knows?"
He lifted the sheet off, and Archer pretended to be surprised. But in the light of day, he was seeing things he hadn't seen last night, which was the reason he'd wanted to come here. "Got an idea yet?"
"Nope. No wallet on him. Not sure how he got here. No car either."
"Is that right?" said Archer. He looked around the body. "No blood?"
"Nope. Just a little on the stiff. Slug's still in him."
Archer bent low. "You shoot somebody that close, you're gonna have blood all over. The floor, the banisters, the risers." Archer eyed Oldham. He was shot somewhere else. Oldham didn't concede or deny this, but Archer knew the man had already concluded the very same thing. He caught Oldham staring at a spot on his head. Archer notched his hat down to cover the edge of the bruise on his forehead. Oldham made no comment, and Archer volunteered nothing. Cops took any words you said and used them to put you in a cage. "Somebody worked him over good. I wonder why." Oldham shrugged.
"To find out what he was doing and what he knew. Why else? And where'd you get that bruise on your narkin?"
"Okay. Tap, 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 Archer. It's called dancing while drunk." Archer stood. "Doesn't look like they were satisfied with his answers."
"If he gave any. So where's your client?"
"I called her office this morning. Nobody answered."
"New Year's Day. L.A. takes every opportunity not to work. But not us county stiffs."
"With that new guy, Bill Parker, in charge at LAPD, you county boys feeling the pressure? Sounds like they turned over a new leaf in the City of Angels." Oldham snorted.
"Yeah. All the rotten chumps Parker fired tried to get on with the county. We told them to go jump in the Pacific with lead feet."
"Is that right?" said Archer. He was not going to point out that a number of county cops had been paid off to form a protective shield around the Clover Club, the nicest gambling joint in Southern California, and just outside of L.A. city limits. The gangster Mickey Cohen had been rousted by this squad to leave the Clover alone. He had retaliated by using a recording showing a high-ranking detective on the take. The ensuing scandal had brought down some top county and city cops. Oldham was just getting worked up.
"Yeah, that's right. I don't like dirty cops. Never have. Sure, I could have looked the other way and gotten slipped extra dough in my pocket easy enough and buy a nicer car with it or take the wife out to a nice place to eat. But I like my Plymouth and I like my wife's cooking."
He turned to stare directly at Archer, his eyes hard, mean flint chips.
"And L.A. is L.A., Archer. No matter who they got in there to clean house, whether it's this Parker guy or anybody else, at the end of the day, the stink will come back like flies on shit. It always does. City of Angels? Now that's a good one. Name me one vice you can't buy in that town."
Well, LAPD did take down Mickey Cohen. Oldham barked.
No, the feds did. That Senator Kefauver got him on tax evasion. Hell, that don't count.
Archer was done with the professional chit-chat. Got a time of death yet? Oldham looked at him funny.
Why do you need to know that?
Just professional curiosity.
Damn, the coroner told me, but I plumb forgot.
Archer eyed the other plainclothes who were staring at him with unfriendly eyes. Maybe Oldham wasn't such a good egg after all, he thought. Or maybe Archer had finally worn out his welcome with the county's thin blue line. You find a weapon?
Nope. From the hole it made in his head, I'm thinking a .38 or bigger.
He side-eyed Archer.
Maybe your client mistook him for a burglar. Shot first, saw what she did, got spooked, and hightailed it. Dames do that, you know.
And the lack of blood?
She shot him outside and dragged him in here.
If she thought he was a burglar, why go to all that trouble? She was within her rights. She'd call the cops, end of story.
But maybe she knew the guy. Maybe she wanted to kill him.
That's a lot of maybes, Phil. Let me throw one back at you. Maybe somebody killed Lamb and took her body and left this stiff behind to confuse things. And as to your theory, I've met Lamb. She's less than half this guy's size. She wasn't dragging his butt anywhere.
She could have had help.
You find blood outside?
Still looking.
And you're saying she went on the lam, and yet there's a Chevy coupe in the carport. It belongs to Lamb. Hopefully her body's not inside.
We're gonna pop the lock and see.
Well, if she did run, I guess she wouldn't want to do so in her own car, noted Archer. You talked to the cab companies yet? Maybe she took one to the train or bus station or the airport.
Working on it. But first things first, we need to identify the stiff, and the sooner the better. So where'd you meet her?
At Chasen's last night. I was having dinner with a friend of hers, and she showed up and dropped her story on me when she found out what I did for a living.
Chasen's, huh?
He slipped out the stogie and looked at his colleagues.
You two ever been to Chasen's?
They shook their heads.
Me neither. Out of the range of my salary. Didn't know you moved in such uppity circles, Archer. You on the take or what?
What do PIs have to offer? Archer countered.
You still drive that fancy car? The one with the steering wheel on the wrong side?
Yeah, but I basically won that playing roulette in Reno.
You that lucky?
I was that night. Oldham lazily scratched his chin.
And she thought someone was trying to kill her?
Yeah. I was going to go by her office this morning to talk to her.
And why didn't you?
Said Oldham sharply, going in for the kill now.
And how the hell did you know to call Barry in the first place about this? Come on, Gumshoe, spill it. I don't have time to kick the shit around with you or anybody else.
Heard the call out about a body being found at Lamb's address on the police radio. That merely inflamed Oldham's inferno. He chest-bumped Archer.
That call came in well before dawn. You called Barry this afternoon and said you heard from a friend of a friend. You sure it wasn't you who called in the body?
Archer was ready for this. I was nowhere near. What I meant was a local associate of mine heard the call out and didn't think anything of it because he didn't know Lamb had retained me. I was actually supposed to meet Lamb at her office this morning. I called there, like I said, just to make sure we were still on. When no one answered, I started to get worried. I talked to my associate, and that's when I found out. Then I called Barry.
What's the name of this local associate?
I start answering those sort of questions, I might as well turn in my license, Phil. Oldham didn't seem convinced by this, but he also didn't seem inclined to pursue it. He put the stogie back in his mouth and clamped down on it. Any of the neighbors hear anything? Asked Archer.
Old lady named Danforth didn't. Said she was sound asleep. She looks to be 100, so I tend to believe her. The neighbors on the other side are out of the country. Danforth says they're in France.
Oldham put the stogie in his jacket pocket, unwrapped a stick of chewing gum, and stuck it in his mouth.
I was in France once, only there was a war going on.
Yeah, me too. It was a real kick. At that moment, a short, white-haired, flabby man in a three-piece dark suit with a soiled shirt collar and a straight black tie appeared from somewhere looking tired and uninterested.
All right, Phil. We can get the body out of here now.
A stretcher had been leaned against the wall, and the two plainclothes were about to lift the body onto it, when Archer bent down to help. I got this side, fellas. They heaved, and the body went on the stretcher and was carried out by the two men. The coroner turned to Oldham.
I'll do the post-mortem this afternoon. I'll take a leap and say a bullet to the head killed him.
As Archer watched the coroner leave, he flexed his fingers. Rigor mortis had completely passed on the body. Archer calculated that the man had been dead no later than around 2 or 3 in the afternoon yesterday, or around 5 hours before Lamb had approached them at Chasen's. He looked up to see Oldham staring dead at him. The homicide man made a show of glancing in the direction of where the stretcher disappeared, and then looked at Archer's hands.
Guess you got your answer on when he bought it, Archer.
You going to file a missing persons report on Lamb?
Not up to me.
Archer turned to leave.
Oh, and Archer?
Yeah?
Happy fucking New Year, you prick.
Chapter 14. Outside, Archer lit a lucky and walked over to the coroner, who was standing next to the meat wagon, while Oldham's boys loaded the corpse in, loudly cursing its corpulence. To them, he wasn't a dead man, just dead weight.
Damn shame, said Archer.
What is?
Said the coroner.
The guy getting murdered,
said Archer, snatching a look at the man.
Hell, if they didn't, there goes my job. Homicide is a thriving business in these parts.
This guy reminded Archer why he didn't like hanging out with coroners.
Understand it was maybe a .38 or larger caliber.
The man lighted a stubby cigar pulled from his side jacket pocket and took a few puffs before hacking up maybe some leftover tobacco from his lungs and spitting it into the graveled driveway.
Looks to be. I'll dig it out. Hey, you work in the case with Phil?
My client owns this place. Me and Phil are trying to find her.
Private Dick, then?
Who works with the cops pretty regularly, yeah, said Archer.
Vaguely, because he needed to be vague, but he also needed information.
Think we're looking at least 24 hours on the time of death?
Sounds about right. Little more, little less. Always tricky. Usually the stomach tells me a lot. We are what we eat, in life and in death.
Did you guys impound a car on this one?
Archer asked this because, despite what Oldham had said about there not being a car, he didn't believe anyone without corroboration.
Car? Nah, nothing like that. Just the body.
He flicked his ash into the grass. His fingers were so thick, Archer wondered how he could hold a scalpel, much less use it to slice precisely through human tissue. But maybe he wasn't that precise.
They got coyote and even bears up here, you know.
The coroner cleared his throat and waggled his wide head, taking his two chins along with the gesture.
Would not have been pretty if the body had been outside, no siree.
It wasn't pretty inside, replied Archer curtly.
A minute later, the meat wagon pulled away with one of Oldham's men driving, while the other one went back inside. The coroner's somber car trailed the wagon, with him idly flicking cigar ash out the window. Archer ground out his smoke, glanced back at the house, and then walked across the street. He stretched and took out his pack of Luckies, but then dropped it. This was intentional, because he knew Oldham's junior-grade man might be watching. He knelt down to pick the pack up and got a good look at the oil slick on the asphalt. It was relatively fresh, which made sense being there from at least the night before. On the other side of Lamb's house, but separated by about a couple hundred feet both ways, were her neighbors, Danforth and Bonham. He didn't know which was which, so he took the one on the right first. The place was large and done in what Archer had come to learn was the colonial revival style, because there was a lot of that around here. It had a main block and two wings with a brick chimney stack sprouting from one of them. Another chimney stack soared into the sky from the rear. The porch was covered and had a wooden railing atop it, and there was a line of dormer windows fronting the roof. The yard was mostly rock and desert ground cover, with a few gnarled scrub trees taking up space. He knocked and then knocked again. He heard nothing from inside. He walked over to the single-car garage. It was detached from the house with a short, roofed breezeway connecting the two structures. It had a copper roof that was being patinaed by the elements. Flowery vines wove through the lattice that covered the breezeway's sides. The overhead garage door was solid wood with no windows, and it was locked. He went over to the side door of the garage that was under the breezeway. It was also locked. He peered through the upper glass partition. He couldn't make out much, but there didn't seem to be a car in there. He gazed around, took out his pocket knife, inserted it between the lock and door jamb, and drew the locking bolt back. He pushed against the door and went inside. Archer flipped on the wall light switch, and the illumination of one bare light bulb cast the small space into murky shadows. The place smelled of oil, grease, gas, mothballs, and mildew, but held no car. Yet there was something of interest. He bent down and looked at the oil slick on the floor. He couldn't tell if it had come from the blue Ford, but it might have. He also supposed most garage floors had oil slicks on them. However, this one looked quite fresh, and if the Bonhams had been in France for a while, their car couldn't have made it. Had the Ford been driven in here after Archer had been attacked? Then it could have been driven away later. Or again, maybe this slick had nothing to do with the one back on the road. Cedric Bender might be safely in Anaheim, unless he was headed for a slab at the L.A. County morgue. There were tools and long-spouted oil cans and the things one normally finds in a garage. He rifled through some old Life and Look magazines in a box. He checked the address labels. They were in the names of Peter and Bernadette Bonham of this address, Malibu. Archer returned the magazines to the box and went back outside. He passed through a waist-high wooden gate and entered the backyard. It was flatter and larger than Lamb's was, with a patch of lawn and perimeter flower and shrubbery beds that looked well tended and watered, though with the canyon walls, it probably got only limited sunlight. There was no pool, like Lamb had. But maybe the Bonhams weren't that sort. However, there was a span of lawn that was lumpy and uneven. Moles, thought Archer. They could do a number on the surface, all without seeing the light of day. Just like the bad guys. He went to the back door and knocked. He decided against picking the lock. A garage was one thing, a home was something else. And if Oldham caught him, Archer could see a charge of breaking and entering in his future, and maybe sticking. Archer made an executive decision and moved on to something else that he hoped might hold promise, but probably wouldn't. And such was the life of a pavement-pounding PI on a slow dance to maybe nowhere. Chapter 15. He walked to the other house, which he now knew was Mrs. Danforth's. It was smaller than the Bonhams, but larger than Lamb's, and older. There was a good-sized bay window to the left of the front door, which had a small Judas window set at eye level. He knocked, and a few moments later he saw a head appear in the glass. The door opened to the extent of the latched brass chain. Two wide eyes peered anxiously through the gap.
Yes?
Name's Archer. He flashed his license and asked if he could come in.
Is this about next door?
Said the thin mouth below the pair of deep-set watery eyes. Yes, it is. I'm working with the police. Forgive me, Lord, for I have lied. You're Mrs. Danforth?
Yes, Sylvia Danforth.
I'd like to ask you some questions, if that's all right. She undid the chain and revealed herself as small and shriveled, with a silver curlicue wig, fake eyelashes, an easily discernible girdle to hold her figure the way it used to be, and enough makeup for pretty much any stage play. He thought she batted her eyes at him, but Archer couldn't be sure. The light was tricky, and so might she be. The woman led him into a small front room piled with two things, furniture and cats. He had no objection to the first, and none really to the second. Even when three of them wrapped themselves around his ankles and one plopped on his lap when he sat down. However, when a fifth musketeer climbed on his shoulders, he did file an objection with the court and picked it off, placing it on a couch. Set across the breadth of the room on a variety of surfaces were pink seashells burned brittle by the sun, frilly hassocks, an abundance of pin cushions, and framed photos with dainty dust-catching doilies underneath. Against one wall was a pre-war phonograph on a table with a stack of records beside it. A large cabinet TV was next to it. She sat across from him, her features somber. Her thin, fragile lips trembled.
A policeman came by to ask questions. He said a man had been found dead in dear Ellie Lamb's home. I can't believe it. Is she all right? He didn't say.
We don't know. We can't find her. When's the last time you saw her?
yesterday.
You remember the time? Archer asked, as he plucked the lab cat off because it was starting to claw his crotch. She tapped her thumb against her mouth.
Tam, it's so difficult, you know.
Archer took out his notebook and pencil and chewed on the eraser end. Well, let me help you out. Was it daytime or nighttime? Let's start with that and work our way along.
Oh, the daytime. Certainly the sun was still up.
How long does the sun stay up in the canyon this time of year?
Oh, not that long. 3 or 4 p.m. at the most.
Okay, was the sun starting to go down when you saw her?
Oh, I see what you're doing. How clever.
Yes, ma'am. I certainly try.
I think the sun was going down. Yes, it was definitely growing dark.
Was she walking? Driving? Did she come by to see you?
She drove by in her car. That little silver one.
You didn't see her after that?
No.
Did you see anyone else around yesterday?
No. The Bonhams are in France. I told the nice policeman that, too.
But other people live on this road.
Yes, but these three are the only houses around here. The others are farther down or farther up, and they're around long bends.
Okay. You ever see a dark blue four-door Ford parked across the street from Lem's house? She looked uncertain.
No, I don't believe so.
Do the Bonhams have a car?
They do, but they drove it to the airport before they flew to France.
When was that?
They left about a month ago. They like to spend time there. She's French.
They fly out of LA International?
That's right.
Her expression grew animated.
I went to Europe back in 1921. My husband, Oliver, and I went by ocean liner. We sailed out of New York and over to Southampton. We got dressed up and danced every night. It was very romantic.
I'm sure.
Oh, where are my manners? Would you like something to drink? I have coffee, orange juice, or scotch.
Archer was a bit taken aback by this wide selection. I don't know. What do you usually have?
Don't let me influence you, young man, but I don't like coffee or orange juice. On the other hand, I am partial to scotch.
Archer glanced at a grandfather clock in the corner to check the time. I guess a finger of scotch would be fine. She clapped her small hands together.
Oh, good. I was hoping for a visitor today so I could open the bottle. I don't like to drink alone, and the cats don't count. And the nice policeman was on duty and couldn't imbibe.
She left and came back with 2 large scotches. Archer noted that his finger of liquor had transformed into a hand. He took a sip while she seemed to prefer a long swallow. So do the Bonhams just leave their place unoccupied?
Oh, no. They have a gardener who comes. He makes sure everything is all right. And I keep my eyes open, too. We've never had a bit of trouble.
She took another taste of her scotch and wiped her small mouth with a hanky plucked from her sleeve.
Until now, of course. Do you think it's the work of gangs?
He hiked his eyebrows at that one. Do you have gangs up here?
I don't know.
She glanced at the TV.
I do watch Dragnet. They seem to have violent criminals all over.
Do the Bonhams have kids?
Oh, no. That's why they can pick up and travel to France for months at a time.
What can you tell me about Eleanor Lem?
She helps me with my cats and goes to the store for me. I don't drive anymore.
And your husband?
Oliver died in 1943. He went out to water the plants and dropped dead in the flower bed.
I'm sorry. Do you have any family left?
Yes, my daughter and my grandchildren. But they never visit. They live in Hartford. Her husband is an insurance executive. Apparently being an insurance executive requires one to live in Connecticut.
So anything else on Lamb?
She was a writer.
Past tense? Said Archer. She caught her breath and looked embarrassed.
I didn't mean that. But there's so much evil out there. You hear of a young woman missing and you assume the worst. They never did solve the Black Dahlia murder, you know. Someone cut the poor woman in half and drained all her blood.
She looked both sick and intrigued.
How demented do you have to be?
Pretty demented. So did she have any visitors? Boyfriends? Lady friends? Not the Black Dahlia, Eleanor Lamb.
I never saw any. She lived a very quiet life.
She ever talked to you about any problems?
Like what?
Anything, really. I heard she stopped going into the office and was writing at home.
I didn't know that.
I also heard that she moved out here to be closer to a friend. Danforth looked genuinely puzzled by this.
I didn't meet her until she moved here, and that was about 2 years or so ago. I don't believe she knew the Bonhams before. She never mentioned anyone else.
Did she make many changes to her house?
Oh, yes. I went over there once while they were working. I knew the Hendersons, who lived there before. Ellie had the pool put in and the kitchen and bathrooms updated and, well, everything lightened up.
What can you tell me about the Bonhams?
Oh, Bernadette and Peter are delightful. They have another home in Paris.
Paris, huh? They must have some serious dough.
Oh, they do. Peter is very successful in business.
What kind of business?
Well, I heard that he worked overseas, sort of hush-hush. Maybe he was a spy. How thrilling would that be? Then he came back and then, oh, I guess he made money the way men usually make money.
And their ages?
Peter is over 50, but Bernadette is only 40.
Second wife?
Oh, no, it's his first.
You say you don't drive, but do you have a car?
Yes, it's in the garage. It belonged to my husband. It's a Buick Roadmaster. Oliver only had it 2 years before he passed. I'm old enough to remember when there were no cars, just horses and buggies. I was originally from Oklahoma. I moved out here when I was a young girl because my mother thought the sea air would be good for her.
And your father?
That was the other reason my mother moved out here, to get away from him.
You mind if I have a look at the car?
Help yourself.
So you didn't see Lamb after around 3 or so? But did you see a cab or another car come up here after she got back home?
Oh, that's right. I did see a taxi yesterday evening around 6. One of those yellow ones. I was eating dinner on a TV tray and looking out the bay window. I went to the door to see where it was going, and it turned into her driveway. She must have called for it. I assume she was going out to celebrate the New Year. I just stayed home with my cats and drank a glass of champagne at 8:30. I can't stay up until midnight anymore. I'm too ancient, and I've celebrated over 80 New Years. It sort of loses its luster after that.
Archer knew that the cab was probably taking Lamb to Chasen's. The only question was, had she ever come back? She hadn't been to the Mars' party, as far as Archer knew, but he would have to confirm that. So where had she gone between Chasen's and when he was getting his head pummeled at her house? And you wouldn't have seen the cab bring her back because you were asleep?
If it was after 8:30, no.
What time did you get up this morning?
Oh, around 7:30. Slept like a baby.
Archer rubbed the back of his head. Yeah, me too. He rose and handed her one of his cards. If you remember anything else, you can ring me on this number. You can reverse the charges. It's in Baytown. She took the card with fingers that were trembling.
Do you think anything has happened to dear sweet Ellie?
I wish I could answer that for you, Mrs. Danforth. I'm certainly going to try. Chapter 16. Archer gazed in wonder at the 4-door convertible Buick Roadmaster, It was thousands of pounds of metal and chrome, with a grill and bumper that looked like the mouth of a saber-toothed tiger hunting for its dinner. Its interior was large enough to seat an army platoon. Detroit knew how to make them back then. He peered under the car to see if there was an oil slick. There wasn't. The tires looked dry-rotted, and the interior smelled like no one had been inside since Mr. Danforth had fallen dead into the flowers. He was pretty certain the thing wouldn't even start. And since he saw a pair of keys hanging on a hook, he took the opportunity to test his theory. Deader than a doornail. Wouldn't even turn over. He left Danforth's, got back to his car, and headed down the canyon road. He stopped at a 76 service station, looked up the phone number, and made another call to Green and Ransom.
Yes,
said the voice. For one frozen moment, Archer thought it might be Eleanor Lamb. Who is this?
Who is this?
The woman countered. Now Archer knew it wasn't Lamb. He explained who he was and why he was calling.
Oh my God,
said the woman.
I can't believe this.
And you are?
What? Oh, I'm Cecily Ransom.
I tried earlier, but no one answered. Don't you have a service?
We're in the process of changing who we use. There's been a gap, unfortunately, but we didn't think it would matter over the holidays.
Look, will you be there for a while? I'd like to come by and ask some questions.
Yes, certainly. I'll be here.
Have the police contacted you yet?
No. Do you think they will?
The county boys are very thorough. I can be there in about an hour, because I'd like to speak to you before they do.
All right, Mr. Archer. I'll see you then. I'll be in the lobby to let you in. The building is technically closed today, of course.
The Delahaye soared like an eagle, and he made it to Beverly Hills in 55 minutes. The production company's offices were in a sleek, modern, five-story glass and chrome building that trumpeted both money and prestige. He parked at the curb and strode to the bank of metal-wrapped glass front doors. One opened, and there, presumably, was Cecily Ransom. She was about Archer's age, and the same height as Callahan, but there all resemblance stopped. Her hair was inky black and hung limply to her shoulders. She possessed the lean hips of a teenage boy and the broad shoulders of a man. She was dressed in dark slacks and a white jacket with canvas tennis shoes that showed off bare ankles. Her blouse was made of silk chiffon, and she didn't appear to be wearing a bra under it. Whether these were her ordinary working duds or her New Year's Day casual getup, or whether she hadn't been home since the clock had struck midnight, he didn't know. Her features were attractive, if eclectic. She wore no makeup, not even eyeliner or rouge. Her eyes were big enough without any such aid, and their mossy shade of green exercised some emotional pull on him. He wasn't sure exactly what.
Mr. Archer?
That's me, he said, showing her his license.
I'm Cecily Ransom. Please come in.
They went up to the top floor in an automatic elevator. Archer had noted that the lobby was as sleek and minimalist in decoration as the exterior, but he still could tell everything here had cost a pretty penny. The lobby marquee had been full of companies with successful-sounding names, and with the rents that Archer knew they charged here, it couldn't be all hot air. These companies were successful. She led the way down a plushly carpeted hall and unlocked a massive wooden door with nice moldings, then ushered him into the cinematic kingdom of Green and Ransom Productions. Nice, said Archer, as he glanced around at the trimly outfitted interior. It reminded him of a ship's cabin. Lots of stainless steel, marble, wood, and no clutter. Potted plants danced in the late afternoon sunlight coming through floor-to-ceiling windows. There was a receptionist desk, walls of bookshelves with scripts bound in leather, and an abundance of film awards. On the walls were photos of a number of celebrities of the day, all of them signed, he noted.
It's a wonderfully quiet place to create, because the film business is so frenetic otherwise. And we're right in the thick of things here. Unless we have to go out to the valley or away on location, everything else is right here.
Got a lot of film projects going?
Maybe too many. Ever since the war ended, people want entertainment and lots of it.
I hear TV is really taking off.
It is. We're involved in that, too. Have you heard of situation comedies?
No, but I've always been more of a radio man myself.
They seem rather trite to me, but people like to laugh.
I tend to work in the land of frowns and tears.
We can meet in my office.
She led him down another hall and opened the door. She clicked on the light and he entered and glanced around. The space was a good size, about 20 by 20. There was a bleached mahogany desk with a deluxe Smith Corona typewriter, lots of pens and pencils in a round holder, a few legal pads with notes in neat cursive, a dictaphone, and a regular phone next to a metal-shrouded Wheeldex that Archer was certain was filled with the current movers and shakers of Hollywood. A wooden chair with back and seat cushions was in the knee hole. A small couch and two chairs were clustered around a low wooden coffee table. On the walls were framed movie posters. Archer noted the credit lines showed Ransom to be both writer and director on all of them. He recognized a few, but had seen none of them. After his experiences in the war, no celluloid images could come close to rousing his emotional interest. The windows were covered with dark roller blinds. On the built-in shelves dotting the walls were stacks of movie scripts and books.
Would you like some coffee? We have a pot in the kitchen.
Thanks, just black for me.
I drink a lot of coffee. I think most writers do.
She left and came back in with two cups of coffee and white mugs. Archer had spent the time walking around her office and taking a closer look at things. He had settled on the couch by the time she returned. They sipped their coffees, and Archer said, "If you don't mind my saying, you're sort of young to be partners with a guy like Bart Green. He's been described to me as kind of a big cheese in this town, and has been for a long time."
He is, and I am fortunate. But I bring a different generational perspective to the business. What entertained people even 10 years ago no longer does. We have to keep up.
Okay. So when was the last time you heard from Lam?
She worked at home yesterday. She phoned here yesterday morning with some questions on a project.
So before the man was dead. I understand she's been working at home lately instead of coming to the office.
She has, but there's nothing unusual about that. I do too sometimes. As long as the work gets done, we don't care where people write. Writers often need to cocoon.
She sound okay?
Yes, totally fine. Look, did they really find a dead body at her house?
Archer was a bit surprised by this clumsy segue. Yes, they really did. That's why I'm here. She sat back and coolly appraised him now. Archer could feel her friendly veneer start to slide off her back like a skin-shedding snake. He actually preferred things that way. It saved time. He needed to understand the real Ransom, not a caricature presented for someone's agenda. She shook out a cigarette from a pack of Camels and lit up.
I write and direct films about the dark side of life, Mr. Archer, but I've never personally experienced it. You must forgive my naivete.
I can forgive a lot, and have.
You might be a good source of material for me.
I might. On her call with you, did she mention that she was going out anywhere yesterday afternoon?
No.
I saw her last night. She knows the actress I was having dinner with. When she found out I was a detective, she said she wanted to retain me. I was supposed to meet her here today to finalize things, and then we were going to drive out to Malibu. Then the body shows up on her doorstep, and she's vanished.
Who was the actress?
Why?
Just professional curiosity.
Liberty Callahan.
Okay, I think I've heard her name.
But the way the woman said it, Archer thought she was just being polite.
Why would Ellie need a detective?
She said she thought someone was trying to kill her. She ever mention any concerns like that to you? Ransom looked genuinely surprised by this revelation.
No, never.
She was invited to Danny Mars's party, but I don't think she made an appearance. I understand that you and Bart Green were at another party.
Actually, we were at several. You have to make the rounds. I was bored beyond belief, but at least most places had good liquor. It made up for the lack of interesting conversation.
And what conversation do you find interesting? Her gaze roamed over him.
Did you know that we detonated a hydrogen bomb in November over an atoll in the Pacific, and that the Soviets are rushing to do the very same thing? It's insane, and human beings are imperfect.
Meaning they make mistakes, said Archer.
You make a mistake with a hydrogen bomb, you could kill 1 million people. And worse, it might not be a mistake. It might be intentional. Because in addition to being imperfect, some human beings are cruel and like to hurt people.
I can see how you would be very popular at New Year's Eve parties. Archer did not mean that as an insult, and Ransom did not seem to take it as such.
I make my movies with a certain viewpoint, with a message that I hope transfers in some way to the people watching. But sometimes I really wonder if I have any impact at all.
I certainly don't want a hydrogen bomb dropped on my head. But right now, I'm just concerned with the safety of one person, Eleanor Lamb.
I'm sorry, Mr. Archer. I carry my soapbox with me everywhere. It's an existential threat to my continued relevancy in this industry.
I'm sure. And you got back home when, last night? She puffed on her cigarette.
Why is that of any concern?
We detectives ask a lot of questions. Some may seem nonsensical.
Yes, they do. I got in around 2.
Do you live around here?
My house is near the Beverly Hills Hotel, or the Pink Palace, as some now call it.
Nice easy commute for you, though.
Nice enough.
Can I see her office?
Why?
We detectives also look for clues. There might be some in there. Archer hunched forward. And let's not lose sight of the fact that a dead man was in Lamb's house. Her car is still in her carport, her clothes are still in her closet, she's nowhere to be found, and no one's heard from her since around 7:30 last night. As someone who does this for a living, I can tell you this is about as serious as it gets if you care about finding her.
Which I very much do.
Ransom fired back. He rose. Her office. Chapter 17. Lamb's office was 2 doors down from Ransom's, and about half the size. Unlike Ransom's, it was cluttered and claustrophobic.
Shall I leave you to it?
Said Ransom.
I know the timing is lousy, but I do have some things I need to get done. It's why I came in today.
I'll poke my head in when I'm finished here. She left him there, and Archer started going through things. Lamb certainly had a lot of film projects going. However, he didn't find much at all to help him, until he jimmied the locked bottom drawer of her desk. He took out the book of matches, one of a half dozen located there, and all from the same place, the Jade Lion Bar in Chinatown. He looked at his notebook, where he'd written down the 2 names from Lamb's Wheeldex cards marked with the X. One had the name Jonathan Brewster, and written under that had been the Jade Lion Bar, Chinatown. The other car had the name Alice Jacoby written on it, along with a phone number. He picked up the phone on Lamb's desk and dialed the number. Someone answered on the second ring. Is this Alice Jacoby?
Yes. Who is this?
Archer told her who he was and why he was calling.
Oh my goodness. I haven't seen Ellie in over a week. I hope she's okay.
Can I come by and see you later? Asked Archer. The sooner we find her, the better.
Yes, of course. My home is in Bel Air, near the country club.
Bel Air, thought Archer. And near the country club. Say in about 40 minutes, I'm just finishing up another line of investigation. She gave him her address. Archer wrote it down and hung up. He looked through the office once more and then left and walked to Ransom's door. He didn't knock right away because he heard Ransom speaking, apparently to someone on the phone because he only heard her voice. And then he heard his name spoken twice with some urgency. As he bent closer to the door, he heard Ransom say clearly,
I can meet you tonight, around 7, at Bolero's.
Archer knew the place. It was a dive bar in West Hollywood. When she put down the phone, he stepped back down the hall, then walked loudly forward and knocked on her office door. Miss Ransom?
Come in.
She looked up at him from her desk.
Did you find anything helpful?
We'll see. Tell me, were you close with Lamb, or was she just an employee here? She said slowly,
We worked together. I appreciate her talents. We got along fine.
He looked over her appearance. I think she appreciated you too.
Did she say that?
Ransom asked with a level of anxiousness that seemed off to him. But then again, maybe not, Archer thought. She didn't have to. He handed her a card. If you think of anything else, he said.
What are you going to do now?
She asked. Keep digging. He started to leave. That's how investigations work.
Wait a minute, Mr. Archer. You said you were going to meet Ellie here today, and she was going to give you a check?
For my retainer, yes.
How much?
$200 up front. I charge $50 a day plus expenses. I've officially been on the clock since around noon. He was not going to charge for last night's fiasco as a matter of personal pride, and also for his being an idiot. Ransom opened a drawer and pulled out a checkbook.
How about I write you a check for $500?
That's too much, and you're not the client.
If you don't use it all, you can pay me back. And as far as the client, I just want you to find her, okay? And I'm sure she'd want that too.
Okay. You can make it out to the Willie Dash Private Detective Agency. Archer took out a sheaf of papers from his jacket pocket. And here's a contract for you to sign. My boss is a stickler for the rules. I was going to have Lamb sign it, but...
Of course.
She made the check out and passed it across to him. Then he filled in the contract using her pen and had her sign. He gave her a copy and put his and the check in his pocket. You really care about her, I take it.
Just find her, Mr. Archer.
He tipped his hat, shielding his bandaged head from her sightline, and let himself out. It appeared that Archer had a new client. Now he just needed to find the old one. Chapter 18. Bel Air had been founded in the 20s by an oil millionaire who apparently wanted separation from those without barges of money, and this place certainly fit the part. It was off Sunset, within a rock's throw of the UCLA campus. Archer passed through massive Spanish gates and headed up to the land of the wealthy and high-minded. The LAPD's Bunko squad was kept busy in Bel Air, he knew, because the con artists swarmed here to relieve old widows of what their hubbies had left them. And these same very dead men had left many a disappointed mistress in the lurch, with nothing but broken promises and memories of late-night hotel visits. And if they were lucky, the occasional private plane trip to Acapulco, when the wives were away visiting family. The driveway to Alice Jacoby's house was nearly as long as a runway. When he rounded the last curve and saw the house ahead, he just had to whistle. In his work, he had seen a lot of wealth, and a good deal of poverty. He had never seen much in between. The mansion conveyed the impression of quiet, refined elegance. It was the best of classic European and American architecture, melded together with functionality. Archer thought these folks might be an anomaly. Rich people with good taste. In his experience, too much money often tended to deliver crass instead of class. He parked in front of the round-columned colonnade and got out. Before he could even knock, one of the 10-foot-tall rounded double doors with knobs the size of coconuts opened, and an old man with a creaky back and dressed in a butler's uniform stood there like a statue. Archer stared back at him, waiting for the statue to speak. The way the man was peering up at him, he seemed to think that Archer had missed the service porch entrance. Archer introduced himself and added, "The lady of the house is expecting me." The statue hinged painfully at the waist.
"Yes, Mr. Archer,"